Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, the editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Companies Editor Stephen Wilmot.
Hello, John.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Excellent. Ian Smith, Deputy Companies Editor, and you've done the news again this week.
I have done news again this week. How are you doing, John?
Not too bad. And in the control room today, Kate Bioli. How are you doing, Kate?
I'm all right, thanks.
Good. Okay, so it's an exciting week this week because it is election week. And obviously that has a massive impact on the markets, doesn't it?
Well, if you believe The Sun, who said the mere thought of Ed Miliband getting elected was enough to send the FTSE into a nosedive, ignoring slightly the global bond sell-off that preceded it, that most other market commentators are pointing to. Another example of how people can really interpret the stock price movements in any way that they wish.
Exactly. So let's start with the global bond sell-off, because that's really gathered pace in the past few days, really. I mean, this is sort of caught everyone by surprise a little bit.
It has. And, you know, some people say it's kind of been triggered by the rise in the oil price, pushing up kind of longer term inflation expectations, and also some kind of more positive expectations for European growth. Chris Dillow has actually written about it this week in our news section. But he said that some of the drivers, I mean, you've written about it also this week in terms of quantitative easing.
Mm.
A lot of the pressures that were pushing yields down are still there. So how long this kind of downward shift in bond prices will go on remains to be seen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I ran Kopok again this month. Kopok, our sort of market timing system, which we've been running for years and years and years. And, you know, Kopok has, you know, it's a pretty good system. And it's been saying buy bonds for a long, including government bonds and corporate bonds for a while. You know, back when there was talk of a bursting of the bond bubble even then, and it never happened, and Kopok has been proved right. And we saw this week the first sell signal on bonds from Kopok, which was the iBox long dated corporate bonds, and obviously, you know, it's quite timely that covers the month of April, and that we're now seeing this very, very significant weakness in government bonds. But yeah, so what I've written about in my editorial that you've referred to is that data from the US has been very weak in the past week. We've had some pretty awful economic data. So the expectations of a rate rise seem to be dissipating by the day. And even, you know, some extreme commentators like Peter Schiff, for example, are talking about how in fact QE4 might in fact be on the way. So yeah, whilst you know, bonds are selling off today, you know, the reality is that the outlook for monetary tightening is perhaps not, again, as certain as it was a couple of weeks ago.
I agreed. I mean, there was some US productivity data out this week as well, saying that productivity had slowed in first quarter after that data around the trade deficit, which had risen 43% in March. So, yeah, the US economy not powering on as it was looking a few months ago.
Mm, and consumption data there, consumer consumption data, and that's a big part of the US economy, has been pretty pretty lackluster as well. So, it's interesting. It's interesting what's triggered this sudden sell-off, the sudden heading for the exits of bonds, of government bonds. And, you know, the oil price has been, as you say, offered as one explanation. And that has risen. So I printed off some graphs before we came in, looking at West Texas crude, which is up past $60 a barrel. That's from sort of the mid-40s in the middle of March. Brent is up to $67 a barrel. So, I mean, this is quite significant, the rise in the oil price. But we kind of expected that, you know, having hit a low, you could argue that was oversold and there was going to be a bit of a bounce back. So then to suddenly say, oh, no, inflation expectations have suddenly, you know, changed. It seems odd to me. Mm. It seems odd to me.
And Stephen, you wrote about oil this week and you're taking stock.
My taking stock column this week is basically an argument why it's a good time to buy Shell. It's more a value thing than anything else. They came out with Q1 statements, the BP and Shell, over the past week. Shell's was a week ago today, actually. And also Total, the French major, and ExxonMobil came out with the results. And basically, they all showed the same thing, which was that the refining operations of these companies have compensated for the weakness in the exploration operations. So although the oil prices really hit their profits in their production arms, actually, lower oil prices are a good thing for their refining arms because they can make better margins. You know, it hasn't offset it completely, but they haven't been decimated either. And the crucial point with Shell is that the dividend looks well covered. So if you believe that the dividend is well covered, even in the first quarter of 2015, where oil price averaged below $50. Then, with oil price looking like it's stabilized, if not, you know, moving up quite sharply, then it really does seem like a no-brainer to be buying Shell when it's yielding 6%.
But what about the BG deal? Because that, I mean, that is a big stretch.
Yeah, the history of mega deals is not pretty, and we can all point to a number which went really badly. However, it strikes me as opportunistic rather than... This isn't about overly bullish forecasts. This is about opportunism on the part of Shell, right? This is a good opportunity. I mean, it basically is a bottom-of-the-market deal, not a top-of-the-market deal. And I think that, for me, is the reason why I'm... I mean, quite apart from, okay, there's big integration risk, as ever, with a big deal. But they're not making outlandish assumptions on commodity prices to make the numbers stack up.
There's cost savings.
Well, there's a lot of cost savings as well. I mean, they've estimated $2.5 billion, which a lot of analysts think is a huge underestimate.
We happen to own some BG shares in our household. And, you know, I'll happily become a Shell shareholder, but I don't know if I'd be buying them with this big acquisition execution risk hanging over them.
Mm.
And it's going to take a long time.
Yeah, and it's not expected to complete until for another year almost. So... That there is that big execution risk.
Hey, Stephen, it's your ISA.
Well, you're the lucky one if you've got BG Shell shares.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been pretty dismal for a couple of years on that front. So I think we were due a turnaround. We've got some Centrica as well. They're having a mayor. Actually, you know, going back to the election, if Miliband and the Labour Party managed to form a coalition, which is not beyond the realms of possibility as we stand today. Yeah, I think my Centrica shares are going to be looking pretty under pressure for the years ahead. The Labour Party and Ed Miliband do not like the utilities at the moment. But there you go. They don't like the banks either, do they?
They're not big on banks. Well, they're not big on big banks, let's say.
Just little ones.
Yeah, they like
the safe little ones.
They want a couple of smaller banks to add to the biggies.
So you've written something on banks this week. Are we out of the woods yet? Has the bank bashing reached a conclusion? What do you think?
I really wanted to give you a definitive answer in this podcast to that question, but I'm afraid it's a mixed bag, really, from the Q1s for the banks. The headline we chose for the piece was Bills, 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 which you may know is a reference to a Destiny's Child song. But the point
of the song,
you know that one, John.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course I did.
Stephen did, yeah. Not lost on you or the readers, I'm
no.
sure. Which is really just to refer to the huge extra weight of provisions that were set aside for PPI and Forex and the other past misconduct of the larger banks that we saw in the first quarter. And that, especially for RBS and Barclays, kind of pushed the share prices down, because I think the market wasn't quite expecting the size of the one-off charges. But there's also reasons to be cheerful, especially HSBC and Lloyds. If with HSBC you can look past the very politicised statements that have come out that have kind of affected the share price. Mm-hmm. There was some good underlying kind of business growth there. And Lloyds too. It looks like the government might have an easier job than expected in exiting its Lloyds stake. This benign credit environment that we have at the moment is really helping the banks. We've heard reduced kind of impairment charges for the major banks. Their wealth management operations have been boosted, the retail banking operations have been boosted. So it's not a bad time to be a big bank if you can lay aside the size of these huge charges, and that's what I talk about in this piece.
Yeah, so looking at the graph you've got here, 2015, there's going to be a lot more big bills in terms of litigation and PPI mis-selling redress. But 2016, it's going to be the lowest it's been since 2011, assuming nothing else comes out of the woodwork.
Yeah, and that's the key point, I mean, with these forecast figures.
You often get that with analysts, don't you? Is that the year plus one is always the great year.
Yeah,
that's when growth kicks back in. And
So somewhere over the rainbow, it's going to be fine for the UK banks.
Well, surely they can't have done anything else, I mean...
Unless what they're up to at the moment, I don't know.
Yeah, well... Okay.
Keeps rolling on.
Indeed. Okay, so, the banks. Not having a great time late. Maybe things are on the turn there. Supermarkets, they've not been having a great time either. Are things on the turn there, Steve?
Well, yes, it wasn't a good week for the supermarkets. I mean, Morrisons issued its Q1 today, and the shares are down 6%, and that's because the... like-for-like figures were worse than expected, and indeed worse than last quarter, so that there had been an improving trend, which they helpfully set out. So sales, excluding fuel, last year, first quarter, -7.1%, second quarter, -7.6%, then -6.3%. And then in the last quarter of last year, -2.6%. And so there was sort of some hope that actually things were stabilising. But this past quarter, so the first quarter of the 2015-16 year, the like-for-like has deteriorated again back to 2.9%. So that's what sent the shares spiralling today. And obviously they've got a new chief executive and he's said very little in this Q1 statement, apart from the fact that he will be giving a big strategic update when they issue their interims.
When's that, which is
in September.
That's quite some time away.
So
I think the market might need to hear something before then. This is a catastrophic performance over a number of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say this isn't the time to be buying back into the Morrisons recovery story. Like, wait until September at the very least to see what the new chief executive has to say.
I mean, that's insane. I think that's insane. I've got to say, my personal view there is I think you need to be getting some messages out there a lot quicker than that. I mean, the one thing I will accuse Dalton Philip of, actually, I will accuse him of many things.
Dithering.
But he took his time. And at first I thought that was quite an admirable trait. And eventually it became the thing that came back to bite him. And, you know,
I don't think
chief execs should rush into things. But in Morrison's case, you know, when you've actually had a deterioration in like-for-like sales again,
yeah,
you've got to be out there.
Well, the thing about Dalton Phillips is he dithered and then he sort of joined the bandwagon too late, overpaying for the Ocado deal and then...
Yeah.
Getting lots of convenience stores that no one else wanted because they'd already sort of started to slow their expansions.
Well, I mean, talking of convenience stores, I mean, Morrison's, the last time we spoke about them on this podcast, they were talking about shutting a number of their pretty much newly opened convenience stores. I mean, is there any update on that? I mean, are they any closer to telling us which ones they are? I mean,
No, I'm just looking at the statement now and there's no real update on the convenience stores. But we also had, of course, results from Sainsbury's yesterday, final results. And it was an interesting one because at first the shares bounced as people saw that the adjusted pre-tax profit figure came in higher than expectations, and the like for like figure was slightly better. The like for likes were down only 1.9%, but then actually the shares finished yesterday down 3% because the analysts came out and pointed out that actually this was only due to the timing of their promotions. So they're in the lingo of food retailing, they're investing in price cuts, which effectively means, you know, they're cutting their margins, and there are more price cuts on the way, but they didn't have quite so many in the first part of the year. So basically the margin has come out slightly better than expected, but no one expects it to stay that way. So then when people sort of started to realise this wasn't exactly a stabilisation of trading, it was more to do with just the timing of price cuts. Investors lost interest again. And yeah, basically it hasn't been a good week for food retail. It doesn't, you know, there was early evidence in the first quarter that the situation was stabilising as far as the competitive situation with Lidl and Aldi and the Kantar World Panel data, which sort of everyone's been watching for market share figures, came out this week for April. And again, it showed that the discounters are taking market share, but at a slower rate, an increasingly slow rate. So there are signs of stability, but I guess the crucial point is that the deflationary environment doesn't show any signs of easing. You know, I suppose one could make an argument, given what we were saying earlier about the oil price, that those pressures might be easing, but I certainly wouldn't be betting on it yet.
No. I mean, the big reason for the pre-tax loss they announced was property write-downs again.
Yes, on a reported basis, yes. On an underlying basis, obviously, they stripped that out, and that was slightly better than expected.
Yeah.
But only due to these kind of promotional issues.
I quite like the idea that they will start giving over their space to third parties.
Yeah, no, this is a good idea. Actually, I thought the strategic update from Sainsbury's in their finals was very interesting. For example, this is sort of going against the grain of what was thought a couple of years ago, but they think there are growth opportunities in non-food,
yeah,
and also services.
Just looking ahead to next week and British Land.
Yes.
So we spoke last week about British Land and its exposure to supermarkets. So I think British Land is going to kick off the property reporting season.
Yeah, it is actually.
What are we looking for there?
Well, yeah, the May reporting season is going to hit us next week, and yeah, the British land will be one of the first, and actually there's a disproportionate share of property in the May reporting season, because both British Land and Land Securities, the two FTSE 100 property giants, have March 31st year ends. So,
but we're buyers of
I wrote that tip back in December 2013, just before I became companies editor, and Jonas, our new property guy, has stuck by us, and you can see why. I mean, it's a really very, very strong environment for property owners. You know, every time there's a bit of a mini sell-off in the sector, as people worry about interest rate increases, something else comes along to suggest that there'll be a long while coming yet. Meanwhile, they remain very strong yield plays. You know, that its portfolio yields 5-6%, and that looks incredibly attractive to other institutional investors relative to bonds, and so as a result its portfolio sort of benefited from big valuation increases, but the shares still traded had a discount to expected book values, so we still rate them a buy. But yeah, the one thing is this their exposure to the supermarket sector. They own a lot of Tesco superstores. In fact, I think from the top of my head Tesco is their largest tenant, that has weighed on the sentiment somewhat.
Absolutely. Okay, cover feature this week. Jonas isn't here to talk about this, but we're talking about buying European property. And partly this is because the euro has weakened so substantially against sterling, although it's come back a bit in the last few days. Is that the result of the election too? Who knows? But yeah, there's a very interesting case for buying European property at the moment. There are many tax implications that you have to consider. There are many procedural implications that you have to consider as well, because it's different to buying property in the UK. But there are some potentially very attractive rewards on offer. So Bricks Abroad is the cover feature, so worth having a look at that. What else we got in the magazine this week?
John Barron, I thought.
John Barron. John Barron, who's a bit busy today, I would imagine.
Yes.
Has written a piece. John Barron provides our investment trust monthly column. He's talking about the attractions of the UK markets, and he likes small companies, particularly those that pay dividends. And he's explaining why this week, and he's chosen a vehicle that he thinks provides the best exposure to that, which you can read about in his column. We've also got a letters page this week, which we publish very occasionally, which answers some of the questions that we receive. Lots on there, because we've been storing them up for a while. Sector focus on the nuclear industry. We've produced a video this week. Mark Robinson, the sector's editor, has interviewed Emma Powell, who wrote that piece, which is very interesting. Go and have a look at that. And obviously, we've got a stock screen from Algie Hall. Low risk, high yielding shares. Exactly the kind of thing readers like a great deal. So, thank you for listening. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Ian. And thank you over in the control room, Kate. I presume we'll be hearing from you tomorrow when you do the personal finance podcast.
We will. Very exciting personal finance podcasts. A lot about exchange traded funds.
I read that piece, and I must admit, I got confused by the names.
Yeah, I saw quite a lot of frowning from your side of the desk.
I think the exchange traded funds industry has got a real problem with the names of its products, because
they're not that catchy,
and a lot of them are very similar. So, you know, maybe I think we should start to lobby them.
That tomorrow, yeah, I'm up for that.
I think they need a bit of a branding overhaul there. Yeah. Well, I just think, you know, we know of occasions where readers got confused between companies with similar names, but you know, in the exchange traded funds industry, the naming conventions are such that, I mean, there was one ETF I looked at that had, I think it was a combination of 8 acronyms that were the name of the actual products, and you know, this is a recipe for,
I think that would be the UBS ETF.
I wasn't going to name that.
Yeah.
Anyway, but there's a serious angle to the piece, which is I think you're looking at the best value UK European ETFs out there, and there's some very good ETFs despite their slightly dodgy names. So
yeah.
I look forward to hearing you on the Personal Finance podcast, and thank you for helping us out today. Thanks very much. Pick up the magazine, 4x50 in all good news agents, and see you soon. Bye-bye.